This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are heroes around you. Maybe your next-door neighbor, maybe someone down the street, but until you take the time to ask, you'll never know the kinds of things that have been done for the sake of our freedom. And we want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, preserve their stories so we don't forget that price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, we learn a lot. We're educated. We're entertained, so often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. And I know that's going to be the case today in Las Vegas, Nevada, with 90-year-old Jim Roach, a 30-year veteran of the U.S. Air Force, dating back to when it was still the U.S. Army Air Corps during World War II. And I know you've been in Las Vegas for quite a while now, but I want to take you back to the early days, growing up in Ogden, Utah. What was life like in Ogden, Utah in the 1930s as a young boy?
It was the height of the Depression.
Mm-hmm.
And life was pretty austere, pretty frugal. Nobody had much money to speak of, and everybody was pretty much in the same boat. There wasn't a whole lot of money around. It was pretty grim, pretty tough on everybody.
Did that mean you had to start working at a pretty young age to support the family?
Well, no. I picked odd jobs in the summertime, picking fruit and things of that nature. But when I was about 14 or 15 years old age, I got a paper route. And that was a lucrative job for a teenager. In addition to carrying the paper route, I did some work in the mailroom, which I was paid for that as well.
Mm-hmm. Did you deliver your papers on a bicycle or on
foot?
Oh,
yes. Oh, on a bicycle.
All the best people in the world have delivered papers on a bicycle. That's what I did when I was that age, too. Lots of fun. Good memories. And what about your family? Did you have brothers and sisters?
I have three sisters.
And so Ogden, Utah, you grow up there. Beautiful city, by the way. The scenery around there, the landscape is spectacular. Must have been a fun childhood. But there's one day that everybody seems to remember. Every veteran I've interviewed, if I ask them about a specific date, they always have something to say. I guess you would have been about 17 years old on December 7th, 1941.
I was.
You remember that day?
I certainly do. I was home with the flu.
Uh-oh.
And I told him, I said, I just can't do it. I'm ill. I'm not well. Mm-hmm. So I didn't do it.
And Utah is a long way from Hawaii. But did news of Japan attacking United States territory, was that a shock to the system? Was that a big deal to you?
Well, I was greatly surprised, but other than that, I mean, I was pretty young. I wasn't too much concerned about it at that time. But then I graduated high school in May of 1942, and I announced at the time that I was to my friends and my family that upon reaching my 18th birthday in October, that I was going to join the Aviation Cadet Program and become a pilot. And everybody thought that was a pretty far-fetched idea.
Had you ever flown before?
No. But I just was enamored with aircraft, and so I thought I would give it a shot. My first obstacle to overcome was getting my parents' approval. I was the only son. They weren't anxious to see me go running off to war, but after haggling with them for a couple of months, I finally got their permission, and so I went off into the pilot training program and graduated when I was 19 years of age.
That's pretty amazing when you think about it, and you think about 19-year-olds you know today and what they're up to. I've got to ask you, you mentioned that you were enamored with aviation. What was it? Was it reading about Lindbergh? Was it seeing planes going over?
We went out to the airport one day, and I saw these airplanes, and I watched a few of them take off, small aircraft. There was no airliner in Ogden then, in those days.
I've got to ask you, you mentioned that you were enamored with aviation. What was it? Was it reading about Lindbergh? Was it seeing planes going over?
We went out to the airport one day, and I saw these airplanes, and I watched a few of them take off, small aircraft. There was no airliner in Ogden then, in those days. I just thought, wow, that must be an awful lot of fun. I better give that a shot.
Mm-hmm. And you did.
I did.
And I've heard a lot of stories from guys who wanted to do what you did, and they went into the Army Air Corps to try to become pilots, but they couldn't make it. They ended up as navigators or bombardiers or gunners because it wasn't easy to get through all that pilot training.
True. It was. When you stop and think about it, it was, like I've told Pat, I said, you know, there are thousands of pilots, but when you take it in context of the population in general, hundreds of millions of people, we're really just a small group.
Well, it's a really small group when you consider what you've done. And Pat, of course, is your wife of 66 years now. I'm going to get the story of how you met before we're done. But if you want a small sample size, guys who flew in World War II and Vietnam, which you did, and in between some pretty fascinating duty in the Cold War that we're going to talk about. But so here you declare as an 18-year-old that you're going to be a pilot. How many hours do you have now in the air?
Just a little over 10,000.
10,000 hours.
But you see, as not that I ever achieved great rank, but as you ascend in rank, you're bogged down with other duties and what have you. Like, I was the squadron operations officer in that spook squadron in Germany, which mm-hmm. ties me down some. And I was the operations officer in Vietnam. But that was a different story because we were authorized 50 pilots, 24 crews. So we needed 48 pilots, a supernumerary operations officer and squadron commander. That would be in the boss.
Mm-hmm.
But we never did have the 50 pilots. So we both had a crew the entire time we were there, and we took our regular turn flying.
Yeah, and I'm looking forward to hearing some of those. And I just noticed the belt buckle you're wearing. It's a B-24
yeah.
on your belt buckle. And that would be the first plane you flew in combat. But you have in your office here photographs of all the planes that you flew in your 30 years in the military. And the first one there is a Stearman.
Yes.
You can go to an air show today and you can see some guys going up in the Stearman and taking people up to feel that wind in their face in the open cockpit. What was that like for you as a teenager to get a taste of that?
Awesome. You know, when you're that young, you adapt readily. I soloed. I was the second person in my class to solo. I soloed with 6 hours and 20 minutes. The guy that finished first, he already had pilot experience. So I was the second in my class to solo. It was 6 hours and 20 minutes. And most of them were going into 10 and 12 hours.
You were a quick study.
It was just like rolling out of bed for me. I mean, I hate to sound boastful, I guess, but I had no problem with aircraft. I mean, it came naturally to me.
But becoming a pilot in the Army Air Corps at that time was a lot more than just being good in the air. There were a lot of things that you had to study, a lot of things you had to learn, to master, to demonstrate that you were capable of. Was there any part of that training that you wondered if you'd be able to master that was any kind of challenge to you?
No, I was a good student. Mm-hmm. I took all the tough courses in high school. I took all the math courses and physics and science courses. 2 years of German, I had it all, and I graduated when I was 17. Mm-hmm. So I had it all. I mean, I hate to sound boastful, but I mean, it was really very simple, very easy. It really was easy for me.
It sounds like you're saying it's what you were born to do.
Well, I'll tell you what. We had a rental unit over here. The folks that were renting it from us were Germans. He was a German rocket scientist.
Hmm.
And they were getting ready to rotate back to Germany. And I told them that when they moved out, I was going to sell that place because God didn't put me on earth to be a landlord. He put me on the earth to fly airplanes. And I don't want to be a landlord when you guys leave. So that was that.
Yeah, and I don't think anyone's going to argue with you when they hear the rest of your story. So another thing that comes to mind as I consider the planes that you flew and all the gentlemen I've interviewed over the years, most of the guys who actually became pilots will usually tell me, well, I really wanted to be a fighter pilot. Did you have that ambition?
No, I didn't. I was ambivalent. I mean, I would just take what comes along. It all depends on where you went to advanced training.
Mm-hmm.
And Luke was the fighter pilot. All the fighter candidates went to Luke. But our entire primary class went into BT-13s and then in the twin-engine airplane. Mm-hmm. So we're destined to be multi-engine aircraft pilots while still in cadet training.
Mm-hmm.
And we had no choice. And it was just an arbitrary decision who's going to go where.
Right. Seems like it worked out all right for you. And how old were you when you got your wings?
19.
19 years old.
19.
And then they give you a B-24 and a crew.
Well, I went to B-24 transition, and that was a tough school for going from those light airplanes into a B-24 because that was a modern aircraft.
And a big aircraft and a heavy aircraft.
Yes, it was. And I'd say at least 10% of the students flunked out, and they were sent off to be pilots and co-pilots in other aircraft. My co-pilot in B-24s was a washed-out B-17 pilot.
Mm.
When he graduated in pilot training, he went to B-17 school, and he didn't make it.
Mm.
So he was assigned as a co-pilot on B-24. But as I said, in B-24 transition, at least 10% of the class were washed out and then sent off to do co-pilots in other aircraft.
Mm-hmm. Were you eager to get overseas and actually be part of this?
This is another story. When I was going to B-24 school in Albuquerque, New Mexico. It's a university town.
Mm-hmm.
And here we were with, pardon me, real young kids with a pocket full of money. All those girls were there. We're having a good time. But there was on the other side of the field was a bombardier school. And from time to time, after those guys acquired a certain amount of flying time, flight experience, then they would be sent off to fly other aircraft. So our instructor came to my flying partner and me one day, and he said, they have a requirement for some pilots over in the bombardier training school. Were either of you interested in going? And I thought about it for a minute, and I said, no, I want to go to the big dance. Mm. And I wanted to go to fly the B-24 in Europe.
Well, and let's think about the implications of that. So you're offered an opportunity to stay in the States and fly around Albuquerque and in that part of the country just to train the bombardiers who are going to go over, and you wouldn't have had to go over.
Not at that time.
Yes, and maybe not at all.
Maybe not at all.
But you said, I want to go get right in the thick of it.
Well, I told him that I was not interested. My flying partner didn't. We both said, no, we want to stay with the B-24 and see what it's like over there.
Mm-hmm.
So we did.
Even though I'm sure you'd seen all the newspapers and heard all the stories of all the planes that have been shot down in Europe.
But that's not going to happen to me.
Uh-huh.
See, it's always the next guy. It's that other guy that gets shot down. You don't ever get shot down.
Mm-hmm. I know this is a long time ago, but when was it that you did head overseas, and what do you remember thinking at the time about what was in front of you?
I don't think we worried too much about it. We were all at Hamilton Field, and we were all scheduled to go to the Pacific. And then while we were waiting there, the order came out and changed the whole affair. We were put on trains, and we went from Hamilton Field to Newport News, Virginia.
Mm.
And on a long boat ride over to Italy, and we got over there, and that was that. It was just, you know, when you're that young, you just take it as it comes. You don't worry too much about anything. I don't think I was worried about anything. I wasn't worried about getting killed. I thought a lot about it when I was over Vienna, of course.
Well, yeah, I've got some photographic evidence you just showed me right here of the flak over Vienna, and we'll put these all at hometownheroesradio.com. Another photo you have here shows your crew. So it's you and nine other gentlemen, 10-man crew on the B-24, and three of you still are alive today. You 10 flew all 15 of your missions together, but my question was, had you had the chance to train with that crew before you headed overseas?
Oh, yes. Upon graduation from B-24 transition, then we were assigned to what they called a replacement training unit,
mm-hmm.
and that's where the crew was formed. It was up here in Tonopah, Nevada, as a matter of fact.
All right.
So then we trained together for about 6 weeks. We flew formation. We did some aerial gunnery, did some practice bombing for about 6 weeks, and then that was it. We all went to Hamilton Field. Orders were changed. We're not going to go to the Pacific, going to go to Europe. So we took the long train ride and then the boat ride over to Italy.
Now, I know there's all kinds of what-ifs, and your story in 30 years in the Air Force, I'm sure we could be here for a week talking about what-ifs. But the war in the Pacific went on a lot longer than the war in Europe. Have you ever thought about how your experience would have been different had you gone to the Pacific?
Well, it wasn't that much longer. It's only about 3 months.
That's a lot of missions you would have flown in three months.
That's true. and we wouldn't have been faced with the weather. Mm-hmm. See, that was the big bugaboo over in Europe, was the weather. It was terrible weather. We'd be on the schedule to fly. And we go, of course, get up and go to the intelligence briefing and get all suited up and get in the airplane and get airborne. And then you might have the whole group, usually 40 airplanes, maximum effort. 4 squadrons, 10 planes for each squadron. And you get airborne and it'd be a recall. So you get nothing out of it. But that happens fairly often.
With that weather.
Terrible weather.
Well, everyone has heard how awful the winter was in Europe in 1944 on into 1945.
Yes.
And you're serving with the 485th Bomb Group, the 830th Squadron, this 10-man B-24 crew. And you mentioned having the 6 weeks to train with that exact crew. What did you come to appreciate about those other men in that time? Did you guys form a pretty quick bond?
Oh, yes. Yeah, we were all very, very close. What can I say? I mean, we were all in it together, you know.
Yeah.
And if there's anything that provides camaraderie in a hurry, is being in combat together. That's so true. I read, and not only did I experience that, I read so much about it. And nothing forms camaraderie that more quickly and more lastingly than being in combat with people. And I found that to be true in Vietnam as well.
I'm just trying to picture myself in your shoes. You've just celebrated your 20th birthday, and now you're flying bombing missions over highly protected targets, and you're responsible not just for yourself, but a 10-man crew on this B-24. Did you feel that responsibility? Was that a burden that you had to carry?
I did. I felt like I owed it to the guys to do the best I could. I did. I tried my best, of course, in the process of saving my own rear end, you know. So.
Sure.
But anyway, I tried to use my head. I give an example. On takeoff, there was a hill off to the left of our runway. I've forgotten the exact dimensions, but the procedure was to fly straight ahead to have 500-foot altitude above that hill. Then you make your left turn, and by the time you cross over the hill, you'd be about 1,000 feet above the hill. Well, a brand new crew in our squadron, the guy didn't drive straight ahead. He turned left too soon, ran into that mountain. Mm. With 2,700 gallons of high-octane aviation fuel.
Oh.
You can imagine what was left of that aircraft after it hit that mountain.
And that's 10 guys gone in an instant.
And it was that was his responsibility, not only for him, to him and his family, but to all the guys on board with him. It was his responsibility.
Yeah,
to take care of those guys the best he could. It was a big shock for all of us because everybody knew that hill was there, and we all flew straight ahead, as I said.
Yeah, and that sounds like a pretty sobering situation. There would be more of those ahead, and we'll explore some of Jim Roach's 15 missions as a B-24 pilot in Europe during World War II when we come back. Check out the photos on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. We're right back after a word about some of my friends who make this program possible.
You know, one of the things I appreciate so much about the veterans we meet on Hometown Heroes is that they're real. A sincere and genuine spirit really makes an impression on me, and that's why I'm such a big fan of Educational Employees Credit Union. It was EECU that spearheaded the launch of Central Valley Honor Flight with an initial donation of close to $25,000, and the giving did not end there. More than 200,000 members know EECU represents smarter banking, but it's not just about being smart, it's about the heart. I've worked with the folks at EECU for years, and I've watched them put their money where their mouth is, supporting their credit union members right where they live in hometowns up and down Central California. From sponsoring first-class Educator of the Year ceremonies to taking the lead in sending World War II veterans on an unforgettable journey, my friends at EECU keep proving that you are at the heart of everything they do. Go to myeecu.org to see what EECU can do for you, or just walk into any branch. And while you're there, if you enjoy this show, tell them thanks for supporting Hometown Heroes.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, visiting today with 90-year-old Jim Roach of Las Vegas, Nevada. He grew up in Ogden, Utah, where at the age of 18, he decided he was going to be a pilot. Jim would spend 30 years in the Air Force, some really unique duty during the 1960s, both in Europe and Southeast Asia. But during World War II, he was stationed in Venosa, Italy, flying B-24 Liberators with the 830th Squadron of the 485th Bomb Group. Your first mission, again, 20 years old, 10-man crew, first B-24 mission. Do you remember feeling a little nervousness, anxiety?
This is what happened. The first mission I flew was I went as an observer on with another crew.
Mm-hmm.
The second mission, we had an experienced co-pilot go with us, and then from then on, we were on our own. But, I mean, of course I felt responsible for the crew. I mean, it went with the territory. That was something you accepted, something you knew that was there.
Did you feel comfortable in the cockpit of a B-24?
Yes. After a while, you know, that flying any airplane, you become accustomed to it in a hurry. Everything's natural. I mean, it's all there. It just comes to you. It's automatic, so mm-hmm. to speak.
I want to talk about some of your missions, but before I forget, I'm just looking at this picture of your crew again, and as was very common during World War II, always some thought-provoking or entertaining nose art on the front of these bombers. And what'd you say the name of this plane was?
Miss Minooki.
Miss Minooki.
Yeah, M-I-S-S. Then my nookie.
Uh-huh. I'm sure that was a conversation starter. And that was one of the many planes that you flew. This other photo that you've got, and again, this is at hometownheroesradio.com. I've had so many guys on this show talk about flying through anti-aircraft artillery, and you can't avoid it. You're flying in formation. You've got to fly straight through. And they say, well, the flak was so thick you could walk across it. And in this photo of one of your missions to Vienna, that's really what it looks like. I mean, how do you find space for an airplane between these bursts of flak?
A lot of them didn't.
Yeah.
A lot of them didn't. I remember one time an airplane was going down on our right wing, off of our right wing. And I called the tail gunner and told him to count. We're supposed to count the parachutes. I called him to count the parachutes, and I was choked up. I could hardly speak. Because it was so close, you know. I mean,
yeah.
Right next to it.
And you always know it could have been you, but in that circumstance, you really know it, huh?
Oh, yeah. I mean, but it's, as I said earlier, it's always the next guy. That's not you. You're always going to be okay.
But on those Vienna missions, when you see those black clouds in front of you and you know you're going to fly straight through them, what goes through your mind right before you enter that zone?
Well, pucker.
Yeah? Grit your teeth a little bit?
Pardon?
Do you grit your teeth a little bit?
Well, I don't know how you react. I don't know. You just tighten up, I guess.
And what does that sound like when you fly through that flak?
We had some shrapnel hit the aircraft. You could hear that.
Yeah.
But no one on my crew was ever wounded. We never suffered any major damage. And it just have to be so lucky, you know.
Yeah. And that picture of a Vienna mission underscores how important that spot was to the enemy, that they would protect it with pretty heavy forces. And you guys heard how many guns they had?
Intel informed us that Vienna was ringed with 400 German 88s. And I can believe it.
That's a little intimidating, isn't it?
Oh, yeah.
And then you see other planes going down right off your wing.
Oh,
but
yeah.
You've still got to fly through and make sure those bombs get released.
Well, you got to hope you come out on the other end, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not trying to make light of it, but that's how it was. I mean, you know, there's nothing you could do. Hold formation and go on through and pray that you didn't get hit.
Amen. And you flew 15 of those bombing missions in World War II, just the start of a long career in the skies for our military. Of those 15 World War II missions, what would you say was the most hair-raising moment or the moment that came closest to making you wonder, hey, am I going to be around tomorrow?
Well, it's that when they went off of our right wing was all shot up and they were leaving it. You could see the parachutes coming out.
Mm-hmm.
And that was about as close as I can remember.
So that means they had the altitude right, and they were just...
They were unfortunate, and they were hit by a burst of flak, obviously.
Yeah.
Brought them down.
What about enemy fighters? Did you encounter any of that?
No, we towards the end of the war, and we had the Tuskegee Airmen.
Uh-huh.
They were our escorts.
Their red-tailed P-51s?
Yes, and there were fighters in the area, but these guys took care of us, and they drove them all off. I was never subjected to an enemy aircraft attack.
So when you see a photograph of one of those P-51s with a red tail, that's a pretty good feeling for you. Brings back good memories?
Yeah, and I used to listen to their conversation, talking to each other, and their lingo, you know, it's almost another language.
Uh-huh.
Because I remember one day, I'll never forget it. This guy says, "Hey, Roy, there's a boomer down there calling you." And I thought, that was the way they spoke.
Well, and I guess it's important to point out that at this time, and the Air Force would be the first branch of service to integrate, but at this time during World War II, the military was still segregated.
Oh, yes.
So the black pilots were separate. And you would probably have interesting perspective on this because certainly they protected your hide on those bombing runs. Did you get the sense as history unfolded that the way those men served in World War II kind of paved the way for the civil rights movement or the way things would be integrated later?
I definitely feel that they had a lot to do with it. Chappie James, have you ever heard of him?
Yeah.
Well, he was one of the Tuskegee Airmen, and they were barred from the O Club.
Mm-hmm.
And so he mounted a protest against that, and they went to the club and forced their way in, and that was the start of it. From what I've been able to read.
Yeah, I've read about that incident. And a lot of them got locked up, and some of those guys are still around. So those 15 missions, you're able to bring your plane back every time. But that doesn't mean that you are without emergency landings, even on a spot where you can read a history book that says, oh, no multi-engine bomber like that ever landed or took off on a strip that small. Tell me about that emergency landing strip on the island.
Okay. It was a 2,200-foot PSP strip, Pierce steel planking strip.
Uh-huh. And that's short. That's
very
a short runway.
Yeah. The minimum length of a runway for a B-24 was supposed to be 6,000 feet. We had a 5,000-foot PSP strip. That was our home base,
right.
1,000 feet short. But in this book that Stephen Ambrose wrote, he wrote that no four-engine aircraft ever landed and took off from the island of Vis. Well, I know that's true. That's one of the things I was going to write to him about and tell him it was not true.
You know it's not true.
I personally, and I not only did I do it, I knew other guys that landed there. Extremely short of fuel and got some fuel and went on home.
And this is a small island in the Adriatic?
Just off the coast of Yugoslavia, the island of Vis, V-I-S.
Right. So what were the circumstances that led you to have to resort to landing there? Because I'm sure you never wanted to have to land there.
Well, the leader, the guy that led the group that day, was a 26-year-old West Point graduate, and he's lieutenant colonel. He'd moved up rapidly. We got off late, and he was trying to get the group into the stream where we were supposed to be. We're talking about 1,000 B-24s.
Mm-hmm.
And there's the stream. Well, for some reason, he thought we should try to get into the stream. He pulled too much power. And we all, I don't think more than a couple of airplanes made it back to base that day, including him.
Mm.
He was on the island of Vis out of fuel. And that was the second mission he screwed up. And he took him out. When you went up north, went up to Germany, you had a primary target, a secondary target, and a tertiary target, and targets of opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
He led the entire group up there. Back, they salvaged their bombs in the Adriatic.
Mm.
And that was the end of him. They got rid of him. He was done. But that's how we ran out of fuel.
You didn't have fuel to get back to your base.
No, we didn't have enough.
So you had no choice but to land on this tiny strip.
Yes.
Was that a little nerve-wracking?
Well, it was tight. I knew we didn't have a lot of room to spare. But being the aviator that I was, I guess I'm being boastful now, but I went in there and got it on the ground. And when the next day we didn't get out of there that day. There's so many airplanes there.
Yeah.
Next day we got our fuel and away we went.
Did you have to warn your crew before you touched down there that this might be a little tight?
No.
That they needed to brace themselves?
No. When I saw that airstrip, I knew we were home free. And we went in and just put it on the ground and that was it. Spent the night there and got fuel and went home the next day. And one of the crew chiefs whose airplane I had flown on more than one occasion, he met me when we landed. And he asked me, he said, was aircraft such and such there on the island of Vis? I said, no, he wasn't there. See, a lot of them didn't make it to Vis. A lot of them bailed out over in Yugoslavia. Very truthful. A lot of them did not make it that far to Vis.
And if they did bail and come down safely in Yugoslavia, they were probably either captured by the enemy or smuggled out by the underground.
Yeah, yes.
And that wasn't a scenario you were looking forward to.
No, not necessarily, no.
Over the years, have you ever looked at that? I mean, I know you've had reunions. There were plenty of people from your bomb group who died. There were planes that were shot down, planes that were lost. I'm sure there were guys who did become prisoners of war.
Oh, yes.
Have you ever looked at that and thought, well, how come I'm the one who had my experience?
It's always the other guy.
Mm-hmm.
It's not you. You're not going to be the one that gets shot down. You're not going to be the one that gets taken prisoner. You're not going to have to bail out. You're going to go come back home just like you should.
Flying those Liberators, what did you come to appreciate about that aircraft? Because I've heard the B-17 guys knock the B-24 and they call it a flying anvil or they say their plane was better or whatever. What did you like about it?
Well, I liked it because it was a stable aircraft. I mean, it was a steady, steady airplane. It had far better engines than the B-17. We had Pratt & Whitney engines.
Mm-hmm.
The B-17 had Wright Cyclone engines. And it was a proven fact that our engines were better than the B-17's engines. The B-17 was a more sturdy aircraft. It would take more punishment than the B-24. But we had better engines, and that was a very, very comforting feeling.
Did you ever have to fly on fewer than four engines? Did you ever lose an engine?
I shot one time. I had one engine shot out one time on one mission. That's all. Nobody was ever hurt on my crew.
Mm-hmm. It sounds like you're proud of that.
Well, I'm not proud of it. It's the luck of the draw. I keep telling you, we're lucky. The guy next to you gets shot down, and you don't. You don't even get wounded. You don't get torn, get shot up. You know, it has to be luck. That's all you can say.
What were the kind of targets that you guys were dropping your bombs on?
Mostly it was railroad yards, and Vienna had a lot of munitions factories there. a tank factory. The Hermann Göring Tank Works was in Vienna, and we were after that. I remember that one.
Was it a big deal when Germany surrendered, when you got that news?
Well, we were very, very happy. We're going home.
Mm-hmm.
And we did. We took a while to get out. We flew an airplane home.
That's a good way to get home, as opposed to on a ship.
Yeah, we made it home in about a week.
Do you remember hearing about the concentration camps and the way that the Jews and other prisoners were treated?
No, we never heard about that when we were over there.
Well, that must have been quite a revelation when you did hear about it realized that the work you guys did helped save some of those lives.
Well, what is a big question in a lot of people's minds is why didn't we bomb those concentration camps? And I said, I can't imagine why we would ever do that, kill all those innocent people that are already being tortured.
Yeah.
But Pat and I went to Poland, and we saw that. We went out and had a complete tour of the place, the ovens and all of the other stuff. It was frightening. It was a terrible sight, wasn't it? It was awful.
Well, and I can only imagine what that feels like to stand in that place and realize what happened there. But on the flip side of that, does that give you some satisfaction or pride for being part of this giant effort to defeat the perpetrator of those crimes?
I don't know that we gave much thought to that. You know, we were there to do a job, and we just did it, and without thinking much about much of anything except fly the missions and pray a lot.
Yeah. Well, a lot of those prayers, it sounds like they were answered. And so you come home from the war. You're not even 21 years old yet.
No.
But you've got all this experience, and you probably had some decisions to make. You going to stay in the service? You going to go to college? What are you going
to
do?
I decided to get out of the Air Force and go to college, which I did.
And where was that?
Utah State.
Uh-huh.
Up in Logan, Utah.
Beautiful spot.
It is. It's a really a nice school. Mm-hmm. Very nice school.
And how was it that you met a young lady from your hometown?
Well, before going to Utah State, I was going to a junior college in Ogden, and that's where we met. She was there also.
Uh-huh. What caught your eye?
Well, it's not what caught my eye, it's what caught her eye.
Uh-huh. Hot pilot, huh?
I have to tease her about that. One time we were at a social gathering, and this lady, the mother-in-law of the guy that was hosting the party, they were from someplace in Arkansas, and they were people of means. They owned a newspaper and two automobile agencies and all that stuff. And she cornered me and was talking to me. And Pat came in and into the conversation. She said, "Guess what? It was just 2 years ago today that we had our first date." And I turned to this lady and I said to Pat, "The reason that Pat remembers it so well is because she went out the next day and bought two pair of running shoes." And that gal thought that was so funny. She liked that.
Well, you guys have kept pace with each other ever since, 66 years now. But right after you got married, I guess you decided to go back into the Air Force?
Well, I graduated in 1950, and things weren't going, there was not much activity in the world at that time, you know, business world, things were kind of slow. So I went back in the Air Force, and as I said, I always liked being around airplanes. I liked being around guys that flew them, and I liked to fly them, so I decided to stay.
And that would mean some fascinating duty during the Cold War and some dangerous missions in the Vietnam War, where Jim earned the Distinguished Flying Cross. Break time again, but we'll explore those other highlights from a 30-year Air Force career when we come back. Find photos and video of Jim on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, and we'll be right back after this.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Our guest today, 90-year-old Jim Roach of Las Vegas, Nevada, originally from Ogden, Utah. He spent 30 years in the U.S. Air Force, retiring as a lieutenant colonel. We've heard about his World War II experiences as a young B-24 pilot with the 485th Bomb Group, the 830th Squadron, flying out of Italy. After the war, he earned a degree from Utah State University before returning to the military. During the Korean War, he served in Germany. He spent some time as a finance officer in California. Then, after learning to fly jet aircraft, he was sent back to Germany. And from 1965 to 68, in that part of Europe, he was part of what he referred to earlier as a spook squadron. The backdrop, of course, the Cold War and the unrelenting tension between the capitalist West and the communist and socialist East. There's a war dragging on in Vietnam, but there's also the underlying threat of nuclear war. So what were you flying in this spook squadron, and what were you doing over there?
Flying C-97s.
That's a big refueling plane, but was repurposed for what you were doing.
Yes, it had different configurations. About two of them had 11 electronic warfare officers positions, the consoles.
Mm-hmm.
And they're searching for signals.
So you have all these guys on your plane that from the outside, if the Germans are looking at it, they think it's to refuel bombers, right?
No, because there was no boom.
You didn't have the boom for refueling.
No.
But that was the profile of this giant plane. Yeah. But inside you have all these consoles. So basically you guys are flying around trying to pick up radio frequencies to find out what the socialists are doing.
Yes. We flew airplanes to Berlin every day.
Mm-hmm.
They called us the Berlin Lunch Bunch. And then we would go down to Athens, Greece, and fly missions around the Mediterranean, hoping to pick up something from a Russian fishing boat or whatever we could find down there. And then we had this one airplane, an aircraft number 106, I'll never forget it. And Dave Brog was the project officer on that aircraft, working directly with the CIA. What they were after was the Fansong radar. We would go to Berlin at the same time almost every day, usually in a squadron. The squadron commander doesn't really do much with the flying end of it. He's busy with other stuff. The operations officer runs the show. Right. Well, I was the operations officer. I was running the show.
So you're running the show and you're flying as part of the squadron.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
So Dave Brog came to me one day and he said, you know, we know that the Fansong is up there, but it's always on standby when we go up there and we can't get the frequency. He says, why don't we vary the takeoff time? I said, how about 6 o'clock in the morning? We'll be up there at 6:30. It's only about a half an hour flight from Frankfurt area, Wiesbaden. And he said, sure. I said, I'll fly the airplane. I told Brog that. So we went up there and he got the Fansong radar. That was a big, big, big achievement.
Right. And I want to make sure everybody understands this, put it in perspective. They heard you mention a minute ago the CIA. What you guys were doing, this was secret stuff.
Oh, it was. Very secret.
Not only were the enemy wasn't supposed to know about it, but people in America didn't know that this kind of work was going on.
Well, I think everybody over there had a pretty good idea. You know, the people around Wiesbaden and at the air base. They knew we were up to something because it was all so clandestine.
Yeah.
All very quiet.
And when you talk about this Fansong, I'm sure a lot of people are saying, okay, what's he talking about here? What was the significance of this discovery that you guys made?
Because it controlled the SAMs. The Fansong radar is what controls the air missiles. With that frequency, with the proper jamming equipment, they could jam that and divert the SAM from its intended target. And it was really a big achievement.
Right. So if these surface-to-air missiles were launched, there was the chance to intercept them or divert them so they wouldn't hit the target, and you're talking about saving lots of lives.
In Vietnam, saved a lot of fighter pilots' butts. Mm-hmm. Really, really a lot of them.
And a lot of people, maybe their minds are blown a little bit to say, well, you're in Germany, but you're affecting Vietnam. Uh-huh. But that's really what it was, because you finally found this frequency that they had been able to hide.
Yes, yes, that's very true.
And it's probably really hard to quantify how big a difference that made, how many lives it might have saved.
It saved Dave Brog's career, I'll tell you that. He was a passed-over captain, and he progressed very rapidly after that.
And I guess the other question that comes to mind with that duty, which, you know, there's the intrigue of it being secret, there's what had to be an exhilarating feeling to finally find what you'd been looking for this whole time. But were those dangerous missions? Was there some danger in flying that route?
If you flew into East Germany, you could be shot down. And we had, prior to my arrival, we did lose two aircraft.
Mm-hmm.
They got off course over Eastern Germany. Both of them were shot down.
Well, how close do you think you came to East German airspace?
Well, we would fly the corridors. We had three corridors into Berlin.
Mm-hmm.
And you couldn't fly above 10,000 feet, and the corridors were 20 nautical miles wide, so we had to stay within that corridor.
But you probably came within a mile or two of...
Oh, yes. Then when we get up to the circle, then we could fly around in the circle, and that was very restricted as well. We were very careful. We used to take the off. We had a couple of our 97s had the entire side of the aircraft opened hydraulically. We had a camera with a 100-inch lens, if you can imagine that. 100-inch lens.
That's 8 feet long.
It's big.
So it would protrude out of the aircraft when you lower that side?
No, it was mounted.
Uh-huh.
Inside the aircraft. So we'd go up to the northern end of Germany and fly all the way down to Czechoslovakia, down around, and then at 25,000 feet and take pictures as far as inland as 70 miles with those cameras. Just probably pick up whatever's going on with the Russians, what they're doing on there, you know. So that was a very rewarding mission.
You guys were able to take photos that had strategic value.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
So you're doing stuff in Europe that's affecting the war in Vietnam and in Southeast Asia. And I guess that wasn't good enough for you because you ended up going to Vietnam and flying a different plane over there.
Well, all Air Force pilots, I think, were expected to put in a tour in Vietnam. I didn't want to come back to the States and have Vietnam in front of me. I wanted to go from Germany to Vietnam and then get that over with. So I volunteered to go to Vietnam.
So this is, I mean, kind of like when you were in Albuquerque and they give you the out. They say, hey, you can stay here in World War II and train these bombardiers. You didn't know how long the war in Vietnam was going to go. You could have come home and maybe you wouldn't have had to go to Vietnam.
That's true. But to give you an example of what happened, a very good friend of ours, he was in Germany at the same time. I was not in our squadron. He was at Ramstein. He came back to the station and was signed up at McChord Air Force Base in Washington, flying 124s and then transitioned into the 135s. Well, I went to Vietnam and came back to the station in McCord, and we became friends. Well, he recently got tapped to go to Vietnam, and oh, he was so bent out of shape. He just thought that he shouldn't have to go to Vietnam. And I told him, I said, well, Bob, why don't you volunteer for when you rotated out of Germany and get it over with at that time?
Yeah, gave you a taste of what might have been had you not made that choice, I guess.
Yeah.
But the duty that you had in Vietnam, the missions that you were flying, again, were very dangerous.
Not really. We were.
You finally made Pat laugh. She's scoffing at that answer.
Well, there's danger in all operations, in all combat operations.
Well, and tell everybody about the plane that you flew there and what those missions were.
Well, we flew AC-119s. It had four Gatling guns firing out the side. I had a gun sight over my left shoulder. Now, if I could acquire the target manually, then I could take care of the target myself.
Mm-hmm.
But if it's something I couldn't acquire visually from my position, we had a night optical sight. The guy was standing in the door, of course, with webbing so he wouldn't fall out. He had this magnified light 12 times, and he'd pick up stuff on the ground. Then he'd feed that to me through the computer into my gun sight, and then we would fire on it.
Mm-hmm.
But it was very effective, very, very effective.
So you were flying at night quite a bit?
All of them.
All night
missions.
At what altitude?
The 3,000 foot was the firing altitude. It would be 3,000 feet above the ground.
And what are you firing at?
Mostly what they call TICs, troops in contact. They loved this because we said we did very, very good work.
So what you're doing with this plane and all these guns on the side is you make a pass and you fire away, you're pushing back the enemy and creating some space for your ground troops?
What we did was mostly we defended Special Forces camps. I was the house over there, so I could pick when I wanted to fly. I always picked the first mission, Shadow 6-1. That was the first one off at night. There was a Special Forces camp over near the Laotian border that they knew that they were going to be under attack because the NVA was in the area. Not the Kong, but the NVA themselves, the regular army.
Mm-hmm.
So they wanted the coverage right immediately upon arrival of darkness. So I took off in daylight, got over there, and we worked the target and refueled and kept working it. I made my first takeoff in daylight and my last landing in daylight. Flew around the clock.
Wow.
And the next day...
You just told me these weren't dangerous missions.
Well...
And don't you think the enemy would have liked to shoot you down so you couldn't protect that?
That thought entered their mind.
And it's not like you're that far up there. I mean, you're pretty close to
3,000 feet.
There's plenty of guns they had that had the range to knock you out.
They did. So anyway, the next day after this mission, 12-hour mission,
yeah,
our intelligence officer says, hey, Colonel Roach, were you flying Shadow 6-1 last night? And I said, yeah. And he says, you got 200 BDA. And I said, well, put it on the board. They kept track of how many enemy you're knocking off, you know. And so I got credit for 200 BDA, whatever that's worth.
And tell everybody what BDA stands for.
Battle Damage Assessment. But it was bodies.
And I know there's part of that. Maybe that even after all those years in the Air Force, that weighs on you, that's a human cost. But how many lives do you think you saved?
It should weigh on me, but you justify it by how many of the good guys did we save. I had it one night where the camp was under attack. Our requirements were we weren't to fire within 200 meters of the perimeter. So this guy was on the ground screaming at me, bring it in closer, bring it in closer. I said, I can't bring it in closer. We're firing right at the edge now. And he said, they're on the wire. We're all undercover. Spray the whole camp down. So I did. I put two on the line. Went into. We used to fly around in a circle.
Right.
And I put two on the line and hosed them down and saved their butts.
Wow. That had to be a little nerve-wracking.
Well, I don't know. That was. You get used to things, you know.
I guess.
You get used to stuff.
But basically what you're saying is the whole reason for this 200-meter buffer is that you don't have any incidents of friendly fire casualties.
Yeah, that's what you didn't want to have.
And basically they're telling you, we don't care. This we're going to be dead if you don't do it.
Well, we're all undercover. That's how he said it. He said, He said they're on the wire. We're all undercover. Hose the camp down. So I put two on the line, half rate. See, each gun would fire 100 rounds a second.
Whew.
6,000 rounds a minute. Of course, you couldn't do that. You'd run out of ammunition, no time at all. When I was firing at a target, I'd always ask the gunners to put me on two at half rate. Two guns, half rate, 3,000 rounds a minute. And then it controlled your bursts, you know, makes you very short bursts.
Yeah.
We'd take off with 50,000 rounds of ammunition, but that'd go in a hurry if you weren't judicious in your use of it.
And people look at that 119, and they're not going to say, oh, that looks like a fighter plane, but kind of what you were doing is what a fighter pilot would have done in World War II on, you know, say a P-47 or a P-51 would have been strafing the enemy. You're basically flying a circle around this position, strafing the enemy to hold them off and save these Americans' lives.
That's true. That's what happened. That's how it was.
That sounds nerve-wracking enough to me. I don't know how it didn't get to you.
Well,
you're just wired that way?
I don't know. All I can say is you get used to things.
You know, so many World War II vets that I've interviewed, we'll talk about the empathy they have for the Vietnam-era veteran and how differently he was received coming back to the States compared to the World War II generation. Here you had some very intense experiences in both conflicts. How did you feel about Vietnam and the way it ended up?
I didn't like it. When we had 500,000 troops over there, 500,000 troops over there, we had no business being over there, in my view. It should never have been. But that's beside the point. For my personal aspect, or my personal involvement, I should say, I was a regular Air Force officer, and that was my assignment, and that's what I tried. I took the assignment, I did the best I could at it, and hoped for the best, you know.
And I guess the other big difference between World War II and Vietnam, in World War II, you weren't married yet, you didn't have a daughter, but in Vietnam, you had a wife and a daughter that you needed to make sure you came home to, huh?
Oh, boy, did I ever hope so. And we met in Hawaii. It was a very tender moment.
Did you ever have any moments where you weren't sure that was going to happen?
I always thought it could, and I prayed a lot. But no, it has to enter your mind, you know.
Sure. You know, before I forget, I want to say thank you for serving our country for all those years. Oh. And thank you for telling us about it, because it helps us understand what a great price has been paid for our freedom. I do wonder if there's anything that you wanted to do in the Air Force that you never got to do.
Well, I would like to have been promoted to full colonel, and that didn't happen. And I pretty much had a good time in the Air Force. I enjoyed it thoroughly.
I've been sitting here with you and listening to you talk, and I see what good shape you're in at almost 91 years old, and I'm just wondering. There's still a few B-24s flying around today.
No, there's not. Only one.
Well, the one that's flying, if you were taking a ride in it and all of a sudden they needed you to hop in that left seat and bring it in for a landing.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah?
I could do it. Well, my 80th birthday, our daughter was living in L.A. and working in L.A. at the time. She said, well, I want you to come down for your birthday. So we did. We drove down there, and she said, okay, we're going to get up early tomorrow. And I said, what's it all about? She said, well, I'll tell you in the morning. So we went out to the Burbank Airport. You're going to go for a ride in a B-24. And she spoke to the crew and asked them if I could sit up front because I had flown B-24. And they allowed me to do that.
Uh-huh.
But had the need arisen, I'd jump in that left seat and put it on the ground for him. I feel sure I could have done it.
Even on the island of Vis?
Well, I could not on the island of Vis. I need a little bit more runway than that.
I guess I've got to ask you, since I think a lot of people listening are like me, and we aspire to have a marriage that lasts 66 years like yours has, what's your secret? Did you just pick a good one, or...?
Keep.
You're motioning to keep your lips zipped?
Keep quiet. do a lot of listening and not much talking.
Uh-huh.
Not only is she a wonderful wife, she's a wonderful person. She has a heart as big as this house. And she's very, very sweet. And she's my and I tell her every day how much I love her. I keep telling her, don't leave home without me. Because I don't want her to go first.
Well, and something comes to mind, and I've interviewed a lot of veterans who maybe got married before World War II and came home and met children for the first time that were 2-3 years old. And that always seems hard, and I can't imagine myself in that situation. But I'm thinking about your military career and flying for 30 years and a lot of those dangerous missions overseas. I bet you've given some thought over the years to what it took for your wife to deal with that reality of having a husband who she knew was in danger for that long.
Well, I think she worried about me in Vietnam a lot. And our daughter worried herself sick about it. She was quite young then, of course. So it bothered her a lot and it bothered Pat a lot. But we prayed for the best and it turned out well. And she's still with me.
She sure is. And you can see photos of Jim and Pat then and now on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page or at hometownheroesradio.com. We're out of time on today's program, but I want to thank another pilot, Greg Shoppe, for letting me know about his great uncle Jim and making it possible to share this Distinguished Flying Cross recipient story with you today. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.